listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Pakistan is a country full of contradictions. For example, although it is consistently ranked as one of the world's most dangerous countries for women, it became the first Muslim state to elect a woman, Benazir Bhutto, to lead it. Yet incidents of acid attacks on girls walking to school, so-called honor killings of women who date men outside of their tribe, gang rape used as a tactic for revenge, and the bartering of women and girls to settle tribal disputes remains prevalent in Pakistani society. In her memoir, Devotion and Defiance, My Journey in Love, Faith, and Politics, Umaira Awais Shaheed, a journalist and two-term member of the Provincial Assembly of the Punjab, she was once called the most unmanageable woman in Pakistan, chronicles her fight for basic human rights for women in her country. I'm very pleased to welcome her to our show today. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
How dangerous is it to be considered the most unmanageable woman in Pakistan? After the Taliban shot Malala Yousafzai, the schoolgirl who became an education activist in 2012, many people seemed to blame her for all the attention the world began paying to the matter of education for girls as a basic human right.
Well, Malala is an emblem and a symbol of oppression on women and violence on women. And there has been recently a lot of accusations on her as being a propagandist in the hand of the West. And I believe my sympathy is with Malala because when the West projects itself as, you know, with this myth of being the savior, it actually damages the victim. And in Malala's case, between this conflict of what America wanted to project and how bad Pakistan felt in the kind of projection it got through the Malala's case, I think it is Malala that we should be worried about. And that needs more. We need to protect her and women like her and girls like her.
Well, don't you face the same kind of criticism when you write a book like this?
Well, honestly, the unmanageable woman of Pakistan was a criticism coming from the bureaucracy of Punjab. And I was considered unmanageable because I would not give in and I was pursuing a legislation which was not in the interest of the Pakistani bureaucracy or the political leadership of Punjab at that time. And because I walked out on the senior member of the revenue board, who's thought to be an almighty in the politics of Punjab, because the revenue department is basically a way of having an administrative control over your constituency. And for a politician to rebel against the revenue department was something that they had not expected. So honestly, the warning or the label or the branding was coming from bureaucracy and not anywhere else.
At the beginning of your memoir, you write that each life consists of a series of demarcations or signposts of experiences. A significant event in your life happened when your uncle, your father's brother, was murdered during a robbery in Lahore. What was it about that terrible event that was so transformative for you?
Well, a reminder that we are mortal and reminder that we have limited time and how life is an existential experience. I look at life as a spiritual experience. For me, it is, I'm a spiritual being going through human experiences. And I think when I look back on my life, the tragedies, the loss, the happiness, the fulfillment are all human experiences. And I think the reminder of how mortal we are also comes with the death of my husband, and that was a sudden death. It was another reminder that we have limited time and we must have a meaningful experience. And I think that's what that has been part of my spiritual evolution.
Well, for some people, tragedies like those lead them to question their faith. For others, it leads them into a deeper faith.
Well, for me, it was opposite. It was a reminder of how I wanted it. It regrounded me in a different way that I wanted an existence of significance, not a existence of success as people define it. What I wanted to do was what I'm doing right now for other people is not I'm doing for anybody else, but I'm doing it for myself because I don't want an amputated, weak spirit. And I think I believe in the strength of the spirit, and that's where my that is what pours into my work, and that's what gives me strength.
Was religion a large part of your upbringing?
Not religion, spirituality. And I've had my ups and downs in my faith, as you will you can read in my book. But I believe that I always had a void. Denying my spiritual side created a void in my life. And I see a connection, a spiritual connection with other people. I relate to life in a meaningful way. I look forward for, happiness and peace, and I think it has a spiritual meaning for me.
Where were you raised?
I was raised in Kuwait, Middle East.
Well, so you weren't raised, you were part-time in Pakistan, but largely in Kuwait, which is a very different kind of Muslim country.
Yes, I was born in Kuwait and I was raised there.
And what did your father and mother do for a living?
My father was in the senior management of a national insurance company. My mother was a housewife. We lived in a very diverse environment. It was a very safe and a secure place as compared to Pakistan.
What was your family's expectations for you as a woman?
I think they always knew that I was a kind of a rebel and I was a nonconformist. And my mother would actually sometimes worry about, because I would disagree on a lot of things. I was very independent-minded. I had a mind of my own. But my father had always encouraged to me to be who I am, to believe in what I'm doing. And I think my father has been a great source of strength to me, and later on my husband. I think I've been extremely lucky in having the kind of men who believed in me, in the form of brother, father, and husband. And this is a sort of a reminder. My life, my book is a peep into a normal Muslim house, a normal Muslim family. You will see lots of men who take pride in having daughters, who celebrate their daughters, who encourage them to be individuals that they want to be.
Well, how much of this is a class thing? Because I would assume that things are different for people who are comfortable economically and people who are struggling, or people who have had university educations and people who have not.
Yes, that plays a lot of role, because the class difference, the economic status of the family, the social status as well. It also depends if you belong to the remote areas. The urban cities are different from the rural areas and the rural families, even though they are economically and financially in a better class. But yes, that does make a difference. I think the families and fathers who have exposure, who are educated, who understand the culture, religion better, are different. They are like my father and the people I know around me. Yes, there are people in the rural areas who are totally different.
Go ahead.
So they are different. So you will see that contrast in my book. How I was raised and the kind of victims that I came across, and what their social standings were and what their backgrounds were and what kind of cultural conservatism they were surrounded by.
My guest is Humaira Awais Shaheed, a journalist, a member of the Provincial Assembly of Punjab. She's written a memoir with the help of Kelly Horan called Devotion and Defiance, My Journey in Love, Faith, and Politics. You studied English literature in school, but you cite two French writers, Jean-Paul Sartre and, Samuel Beckett isn't a French writer, but he's an Irish-French writer, as your literary crushes. What was it about them that inspired you?
Well, the whole idea of existentialism, and I was actually inspired by the absurdists, and I think it is one of my philosophical probings of what our existence is about and what is the meaning of being alive, how much control do we have over lives. And I think it was a philosophical preoccupation when I was a student.
As an absurdist?
Yeah, as an absurdist. I mean, there has been a sort of a morbid side of me that was obsessed with death and the meaning of life. And I've readdressed those questions in different phases of my life.
Did your parents begin to receive inquiries about you as a potential bride for eligible men when you left school?
Well, it's a very common thing. Once you enter your late teenagers, you start getting proposals of marriages.
And your parents had an arranged marriage.
My parents had an arranged marriage, but I could not see myself fitting into that at all.
So you continued. You got a master's degree. How did your role as an academic inform your work as an activist for women's rights?
Well, when I was teaching at the Fatima University in Rawalpindi, I realized that I was exceedingly interested in the feminist writers and the feminist perspective. And I think it did affect the way I thought. It did make me focus on women writers, women issues. And when I finally got an exposure to real life stories, I could connect. I did have the background to understand it, to contextualize it.
By this time, you had moved back to Pakistan.
Yes. I moved back in my late teenage. I started my college in Lahore.
You say that for women, Pakistan is divided into two. Can you explain?
Well, you will see extreme examples of women who are oppressed, women who face brutality and violence. On the other hand, you will also see, I mean, recently we have women elected to the parliaments. There are women in the bureaucracy. There are women who are very outspoken. There are women writers. There are women intellectuals. And there are women leaders like Benazir Bhutto. So we do have parallel, two sides, contrasting pictures of women. Women on the one hand extremely oppressed, and women on the other hand extremely forward going. And I think this also makes us think about two kinds of men as well.
Now,
and, the men who are tolerant and men who respect women and men who are open to women. And on the other hand, you have men who throw acids on the face of women. You have women, you have men who actually, do domestic violence, who are brutal to their women.
Well, Benazir Bhutto was assassinated. Probably has nothing to do with the fact that she was a woman.
I think that it had to do with her political... It was a political position and her political views and her political role.
Now, Zia-ul-Haq, a previous leader, instituted Sharia law into Pakistan. And often when some of these things that we're talking about occur, people say, well, it is part of Sharia law and women should be in a subservient position. Does the Quran actually say that?
Well, my concern is that Islam is right now, the kind of Islam I see in Pakistan is like, I call it Islam, Puritanic Islam. The obsession with women's sexual morality and the obsession with how women dress up and their sexual behaviors has become obsessive in the last few decades. And I think a lot of that has to do with the empowerment of the clergy and the judgmental attitude of the clergy. So coming back to what Sharia is, I think 70%, and a lot of Islamic scholars will agree with me, 70% of the Sharia is about economic matters, business transactions, ethics in your trade, and about economic justice and social welfare. Unfortunately, Sharia has been used out of context for specific reasons and specifically focusing on women and their sexual behaviors. And I totally disagree because I understand that Islam is much more than the ankles of a woman and the amount of hair that she shows.
We have to take a little break. We'll come back with Humaira Awais Shahid, who has written a memoir with the help of Kelly Horan called Devotion and Defiance, My Journey in Love, Faith, and Politics. It's published by Norton. Stay with us. We're back with Humaira Awais Shahid. I hope I'm pronouncing your name correctly.
Yes, you almost right.
I'm trying to, anyway. How would you say it?
Humaira Awais Shahid.
Okay, well, I'm kind of close. She's
yes.
Written a memoir with the help of Kelly Horan, called Devotion and Defiance, My Journey in Love, Faith, and Politics. It is published by Norton. What are some examples of how women are treated as property in Pakistan? And can you tell us what Vani is?
Well, Vani is where women are bartered as a compensation for the crimes committed by their family, male family members. Like in one of the stories in my book where the brother has an illicit relationship with the other tribe, and the compensation they ask is the forced marriage of two sisters with two brothers from the other tribe. And it was one of the stories that we were able to make a difference because our investigative team reached at time. We were able to question the clergy. We were able to mobilize people, and that did get reversed. We were able to rescue the girls. But this is a customary practice.
Are there two justice systems? Are there two justice systems working in Pakistan, the regular legal system and this kind of legal system, which is on a tribal level?
Yes, we call it village councils, we call it panchayat jirgas, and the informal justice system is functional because the judicial process is so slow and so expensive for the rural people and the poor people that is impossible to receive any conflict resolution for them. We had a law made in the tenure of President Musharraf at that time, and wani and honor killings and other customary practices were made punitive and they were abolished. But the customs still remain there. I mean, women in compensation as for robbing or stealing the cattle still goes on. I think what we need is more an implementation of those laws now that we have the laws. But the village councils, ours, you know, is another way of speedy justice for the local people. But it does harm women in lots of cases.
And there's still a strong tribal presence in Pakistan, despite the fact that the country gained independence 66 years ago?
I think the tribal is more in the northern areas, in the Punjabi politics and in the Punjab. It is caste. Mm-hmm. The caste is
like
very
India.
Important there. Yeah, but it's not the caste in that way. I mean, we have Rajputs versus the Gujars, and they're different, and they have their own affiliations, their own alliances because of the castes.
Well, I wonder, because many of the things you're describing are also occurring in India, and we've had these terrible rapes in India recently. How do you think that this is as much to do with the culture of the Indian subcontinent as it has to do with Pakistan or India?
Well, there are multiple reasons. I think the violence happens because violence is allowed. And a lot of it has to do because the laws are not implemented. A lot of it has to do because the police is corrupt. I also, being the lead advocate for the International Violence Against Women Act, and I'm surprised that how one in every five women American women goes through a violent experience. 31% of U.S. women have been physically or sexually abused by an intimate partner. So there's something that I need to understand too. I mean, I understand in Pakistan, the violence is so prevalent because lawmaking, law providing and law enforcing agencies are corrupt and negligent. But in a country like America, that makes me question that, is this deeper than that? Is it... I also question the structural violence within the system. I also question, is there a deep misogynist strand that runs through societies?
Well, people are prosecuted for committing those crimes, and the police generally do try to go after the perpetrators. It's slightly different. We don't have acid attacks on women because they're not wearing headscarves. But I think that misogyny is a problem all over the world, unfortunately. Now, you said that your husband was not. How did you meet Adnan Awais Shaid?
Well, I met him. I just completed my master's, and I was. It was one of my early jobs I took up as a student coordinator in the Imperial College in Lahore. And Adnan was about to complete his second degree as a master's in business administration. So he was part of the student council, and I was part of the administration who represented the students, and that's how we met each other.
Did you know that he came from a family that was prominent in Pakistani media?
No, I had no idea who his family was in the beginning. And besides, I was so disinterested because I was raised in Kuwait and I had very little exposure to the Pakistani media scene or the political scene. It's only later that I realized that he comes from a media family.
And then you made a professional transition from being an academic to being a journalist. You were offered a job at one of your father-in-law's newspapers, the Daily Khabrein?
Yes. And the reason was my father-in-law actually kept on trying to convince me that write in the newspaper, and he gave me all the opportunity and the encouragement. And I was so much involved in my academics, I wasn't interested in the beginning. But I think the activist streak was tempted. And then I realized that it was much more exciting and interesting and meaningful if I could try make a difference
and then
through the newspapers.
And then you assume the role of editor in the weeks following the 9/11 attacks just prior to the U.S. war in Afghanistan. What was the atmosphere in Pakistan like at that time?
I remember there was a strong streak coming from the religious political parties that we should not ally with the America at that time. And I remember one of the days that I have been speaking about in my book is about a protest going out outside our office, and it was by the religious groups who said this is not our war and we should not go against a Muslim country by becoming an ally with America. There was a reaction to the bombings, the initially bombings on Kabul at that time. And there was a strong, I mean, the media did project very strongly the images of children and women who were bombed.
But
Doesn't
Islam condemn killing of innocent people?
Of course.
The 9/11 attacks, I'm surprised that the religious community would have supported those attacks, considering the fact that it goes against what Islam says you should be doing.
Yes, it was. But I think what they said, they kept on claiming, is we had nothing to do with those. That was done by individuals. And secondly, I think there was a sympathy, of course, with the 9/11 victims. But
Some of whom were Pakistani.
Yes, some of them were Pakistani. But you see, it's the whole idea that Saudi Arabia should have been questioned more than Pakistan. But you see, Pakistan was dragged into this war while Saudi Arabia was never questioned about that.
I'm talking with Humaira Awais Shaid. I'm probably messing it up again. Her book is Devotion and Defiance, My Journey in Love, Faith, and Politics, published by Norton. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. How would you describe your newspaper's coverage of women's issues when you started there?
I found it very non-serious and frivolous at times also, because it was obsessed with fashion, what to buy, what to wear. And I thought, not that I'm against the entertaining side of the women issues, but I thought we could use that space for more significant issues. And usually, the human rights stories that were pushed inside and were reduced to one column news, I thought we could analyze them, we could have people talk about them, we could probe the issues in more depth by using that space on women issues.
In the book, you describe an early meeting with your boss, who also happened to be your husband, where you recited a list of articles and public forums that you wanted your reporters to pursue, such as?
Such as, I wanted to do stories on prostitution, I wanted to do stories on child beggary, I wanted to do issues on women jails. You see, I saw a lot of, these were serious issues and were not usually given the space and the depth that they require. And he used to think that I am obsessed with violence and I'm obsessed with exploitation of women. But that's something I've always been preoccupied with.
So what was his reaction? I mean, he is a supportive husband. He was a supportive husband. But at the same time, he was a businessman.
Yeah. I think he was a balancing factor. And my being so intense and overpassionate about issues, he was always the balancing factor. And he made us work hard on those theories, and we had to qualify, and we had to be good enough in order to get the kind of space that we wanted. He was a strict boss in the end.
You overhauled an editorial feature called The Helpline. Can you talk about The Helpline and some of the social issues that it helped shed light on?
Well, the helpline was a thing that was started by my father-in-law, and he's thought that people could approach us with the stories of exploitation and maybe we do need to dedicate a part of our newspaper to these stories. And I realized that the whole helpline department was a little slow, and they were not catering to the needs of the people who were approaching us. So I took more interest in that. And what I realized that a lot of women were walking to our office with their stories, and stories of brutal violence and stories of exploitation. And a lot of the stories that I am actually quoting in my book as well were women who approached me through the helpline. And I realized that once that we announced that we are here, women and people approached us.
Now, how did you wind up in politics?
Totally by accident. I never thought. I never even had an idea that I would end up in politics. President Musharraf at that time made a reform, and we had 17% proportional representation before the 2002 elections. So there was an opening for women on reserved seats, and Sardar Farooq Khan Laghari, who's the former president of Pakistan, was a very close family friend, and he had recently had his own political party and with the name of National Alliance, and they were looking for female candidates. And basically the concept of a reserved seat was to bring women from different backgrounds in order to enrich the parliament with their experiences. So my being journalist was an add-on, and I was approached by their party, and I was approached by the former president to join them. And I was reluctant because I didn't see myself fit to be there. Number one, most of us who entered the parliament on the reserve seats for the first time were not even coming through the political process. Plus, I didn't know that I would be able to make any difference there.
So Musharraf, despite his faults, did try to improve the lives of women in Pakistan. But why 17? Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I think we owe that to President Musharraf because he did bring 21% representation of women in the local government and 17% in the parliaments.
Well, why 17%? Why not 50%? Or, after all, women represent half the world.
Well, even the 17% has been so fragile, and there has been a lot of criticism on the reserve seats to reverse that. And I'm glad we've not been able to reverse it. But for a country like Pakistan, where you only have 3% of women in the parliament, 17% was a big leap.
So when you raise resolutions to improve the status of women's lives, how were they received by the male assembly members?
Much to my expectation, I did not see a lot of opposition. What I saw was people were disinterested. Human rights issues were not mainstream issues. They were not the priority of political parties. They were not the priorities of most of the members. But once when I brought these issues forward, I was doing an individual lobbying for them. They agreed. They were willing to vote. So that was encouraging for me. Much to my experience, I had more problems on the money lending bill than on the women issues.
But with the deep-seated prejudices against women in Pakistani culture, isn't it difficult to enforce laws even if they're passed?
Yes, that is a problem. Because, you see, until you don't have implementation mechanism and you don't have the kind of enforcement that is required, it is very difficult to implement the laws. And that is one of the reasons that I think the biggest problem of Pakistan is lack of accountability. When you commit a crime and you get away with it, it is not a good precedent. This only leads to for things to escalate.
Now, you did propose some laws that were rejected. What was the problem there?
Well, a lot of issues was that they didn't come under the provincial legislative list, and those laws required changes and amendments in the Pakistan Penal Code, which is a federal jurisdiction. So I did have problems with that. There were others that my party didn't agree with, and there were others that, I wanted to pass a resolution against honor killings, and somehow it didn't go through.
Now, this book also tells about your fair share of tragedies that you've experienced, including a stillborn child, postpartum depression, in 2007, the sudden death of your beloved husband. How have these hardships shaped your outlook on your work as an activist? Or have they?
Of course they have. I mean, the reminder of my being a mortal and reminder that the kind of loss and tragedies that are inevitable in life, it grounds me in a different way. I honestly, I'm doing this work not for others. I'm doing it for myself. I'm doing it because I want a strong spirit. And my tragedies are my treasures in the way, because it evolved me into a kind of empathy and compassion which I wouldn't have been otherwise. To walk on the ground beneath which a piece of your heart is buried is the most humbling experience of your life. And I think it humbled me for life.
Thank you so much for being on our show. Humaira Awas Shaid has written, with the help of Kelly Horan, Devotion and Defiance, My Journey in Love, Faith and Politics. It is published by Norton. It's been a pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you. It was a pleasure to speak to you, too.